one of the biggest gaming bills in Indiana's history. A person of wealth speaks at Purdue. That plus potential changes to Indiana's alcohol laws and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending February 8, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Senate lawmakers began what one person called the first act of a three-act drama, debate on major changes to Indiana's gaming industry. The bill does three big things. It allows a Gary casino to move inland away from the waterfront, it allows a casino to open in Terre Haute, and it legalizes sports wagering, including online. The sports wagering portion drew wide support among those who testified, but the other provisions generate sharp divisions. In support were people from the cities of Terre Haute and Gary, whose leaders say the casino changes would be a game changer. Perhaps not surprisingly, the state's other casinos don't like the bill, even though it includes provisions that help compensate communities that lose money because of shifting gaming revenues. But casino lobbyists say that doesn't help the casinos themselves. For instance, the French Lick facility estimates it will lose 20% of its business if a casino opens in Terre Haute. Will the gaming bill make it to the finish line largely intact? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, these are big issues lumped together in one package. Is that the best strategy?
Well, so far the bill came out 10-0, right? So
check this one off the list.
There has yet to be a no vote cast against the gaming bill this year, so that's notable. This is a huge bill. It has a statewide impact. It impacts the other properties. Obviously, the two boats up north impacts Terre Haute, impacts City of Gary, impacts Anderson and Shelbyville, right? So, and because of all those things, if you one off all those things and put them in three or four different bills, then you would have to consider in separate conversations how one piece of legislation is affecting all these other moving parts. So, I think that's probably why the lawmakers opted to put all of this into one package, so that they could have an open discussion like they did on Wednesday afternoon about not only what is the upside to moving a boat off of Lake Michigan into Gary or to Terre Haute ultimately. What's the benefit of moving up the date when table games can be at the horse tracks? Yep. And what does that mean for the rest of the casinos in the system? Because you have seen some of these casinos thrive around the state. You've seen others when Cincinnati opened. You've seen some of the southeast part of the state begin to suffer. So when you make one change, it does have a systemic effect throughout the industry.
Is the fact that they put everything all in one the way this actually does get to the finish line? Because there's a little bit for everybody to love and a little bit for everybody to hate?
I think that's what the design is. And you certainly have an awful lot of lobbyists for the gaming industries running around the halls of the state legislature. But I think the issue of the sports betting in particular deserves more scrutiny. There are potential problems with some of this, and it ought to be debated at length separate from the casino issues and where the casinos are operating. I mean, for cities like Terre Haute and in particular, you know, that are not thriving, they've lost a lot of industry. It's probably not coming back in the foreseeable future. And there's nothing else around them on the Illinois side within like a 50-mile radius. Yeah. So it has some appeal from that point of view. On the other hand, I think the legitimate concern about what this does to existing facilities, particularly in Evansville and French Lick. And we need to address those because, in particular, I think the French Lick facility has been a boon of tourist-wise to Indiana, yep. And I'd hate to see anything upset that apple cart. So I think it needs debate, and I also think the sports betting industry needs much closer scrutiny and not pushed through by the myriad of senators on the Republican side who may even be qualified as lobbyists, since all they seem to do is push bills related to gambling.
When we got this first round of committee testimony, the vast majority of the time was spent talking about all the casino changes. There was some discussion of sports wagering, but not a ton, and it was all mostly positive. Because it's right now lumped into that much bigger bill, is it going to kind of fly under the radar as we go forward?
Yeah, it is. And I don't think that's necessarily good for Hoosiers. I mean, I think it's, I mean, moving one casino here or there, like, we kind of know the impacts. But, you know, we've never had legalized sports wagering here in the state. That's a completely new topic. And somehow we've already decided from the get-go that it should be at casinos and this and that. And we've kind of lumped it all in there. And I'm concerned that it's not going to get the, you know, the dissection that it deserves.
Apart from dissection, a lot of people seem to be supportive, obviously, again, of the sports wagering part. Do you risk it going down in flames because the other stuff is more controversial if you keep it as part of this one big package?
Well, there's clearly a reason for this desire to, A, put it all together. That's been articulated, because then you do have a better chance of taking, as you described it, Brandon, you know, the good with the bad. Everybody right. suffers equally. But in terms of the sports wagering specifically, that the reason I think there's this, you know, dash to the finish line, to use your metaphor earlier, is what a consultant said, who was brought in to look at this issue during the off season, if you will.
Yeah.
And they were pretty clear that they said, yeah, there are risks associated, and Ann alluded to this, in terms of how this is structured, who conducts sports gaming, who derives tax benefit, et cetera, et cetera. But the consultant made clear that the bigger risk is for Indiana not to jump on it now. I don't think that there's
a what's
belief.
The bigger risk? We wouldn't
well,
get
the
$15 million
is if,
in revenue?
Well,
yeah,
that's
the bigger risk.
Well, the belief is that if Indiana doesn't jump now, it misses out forever, because other more established players will come into the market, either legal or illegal, offshore, onshore, and Indiana misses out. Now,
Indiana would be one of the first states.
Right. So the question then
to jump
is,
in
are the dollars
the
attached worthy of, you know, that?
Part of that's a function of just our legislative calendar, too. I mean, some states pre-passed sports gaming legislation.
Yeah, I think that's why Delaware was like the first to go, right. because they had pre-passed that legislation.
I think there is merit to the argument that we would lose out on certainly the opportunity to be what a bigger piece of whatever pie is out there. I think that's true. Whether or not it's worth the trouble is another question.
And given our size, I don't know how big a piece of the pie we're ever going to be anyway.
Yeah, because what they're talking about is opening. You would, I mean, even one of the things they said for the online gaming is basically geofencing it, so that if you're from Ohio, you're not using Indiana's sports wagering system in Ohio. You have to be in Indiana to do
it. It's like fantasy sports was a couple years ago, where each state kind of put a lid on it until they passed legislation to essentially regulate it.
Well, billionaire Howard Schultz, who's considering an independent run for president, delivered a speech at Purdue University this week.
The address at Purdue was Schultz's first speech since he announced he was mulling a presidential bid. The former Starbucks CEO spoke at the invitation of the Purdue Student Government Association. His remarks largely resembled a campaign speech. He talked about a need for, quote, authentic leadership, further tax reform, concerns about the national debt, and the necessity of what he called a viable health care solution, though he offered no detailed explanation of what that would be. And the billionaire addressed something that's dogged him since he first announced his potential run, that such a bid would help President Donald Trump win re-election. Schultz spoke critically of Trump and said unequivocally that he, quote, must not serve a second term.
And Delaney, what kind of impact would Schultz's run have?
I don't think it'll have very much. I mean, you've got a billionaire businessman who's made a fortune making mediocre coffee all around the world. And for that qualifies him to be president. I guess since we have Donald Trump, maybe it does.
Well, there goes my Starbucks sponsorship deal. Thanks a lot.
Sorry. But the fact of the matter is, no independents ever won. You know, and
no, but that's not. But winning is not necessarily.
No, that's right. And it could be. It'd be interesting to see what kind of impact he'd have on Indiana, for example. So there are things like that. But you have to first, the obstacles to even getting on the ballot in the 50 states are substantial. You need to have it's not enough to write a check. You have to have a grassroots movement in every single state to qualify. I don't see that enthusiasm.
I'm going to come back to that point in a moment. But I want to ask you about, Schultz addressed this question head on in his speech. He said, you know, I know a lot of people have been saying, if I run, it'll help Donald Trump, and I won't let that happen. But
well, then probably go find a candidate and support another candidate from one of the two parties, because this is a big risk. I think the reaction to this was immediate and negative from kind of institutional establishment Democrats. I mean, Barack Obama's 2012 campaign manager just came out and blistered him. And there were 10 of those examples of high-profile Democrats coming out hard. Politico has a profile this weekend, kind of expansive profile of Schultz, and they interview his former business partners who say he's a crook and he's bad to employees and he didn't provide them health care and he didn't do all these things. So Democrats are not letting this kind of get any traction or just go, oh, this is just an eccentric billionaire who's going to flame out. I mean, they're trying to kill him on
that's what he is.
If he stays in this long enough, Ann brought up the point that it is hard to get on the ballot in a lot of places. Indiana's considering a possibility that it might not be so hard. They're considering a measure that would say instead of having to do all the signatures to be on the presidential ballot, you just write a $20,000 check in the first week of registration.
Presumably, Trump's going to let that happen when he's trying to shut down all opposition?
Maybe. Presumably, Mr. Schultz could somehow he could together enough money to back
somehow,
that check, I suppose.
He is a person of means.
He is, yes. First of all, clearly, let's say take your question in different segments. The first part, can it have an impact? Yes, it would have an impact. And as I've said before, anybody who doesn't think independent candidacies can have an impact should talk to President Gore, because Ralph Nader's in participation in Florida
or President
alone.
President Clinton.
You can cite any number of examples.
Three races in a row where it mattered.
So it would have an impact. But I don't think he even gets to the gate, because the reaction I sensed that, and it wasn't just establishment Democrats, it was establishment Republicans. I think people are
just seem to like this.
There wasn't a lot of love in the room, and I'm not sure in this era of trying to gin up support by being a firebrand on either side of the political scales,
But that's not also what he is.
Well, no, he's not, but I don't think that sells. I don't think he gets traction with being, I'm going to be a centrist, I can actually get my spreadsheet out, and when I'm done pressing the button, all my numbers are going to add up.
I don't think that gets votes.
That's true. To the point of Indiana potentially making it easier to get on the presidential ballot, Ann just brought up a good point, which is that's not necessarily good news for Donald Trump as much as it is somebody like Howard Schultz.
Well, I mean, you can look at the immediate races, but I just don't really see that going all the way through the process. I think it's an interesting topic to have. And as far as Mr. Schultz, I guess I'm of the more the merrier, because, I don't want to just foreclose good ideas or good people, by saying we already know what would happen. I think a year out before, when Donald Trump was president, no one could have said that a reality TV producer would be president. So.
Okay, but we don't know that he's either a good person.
Yeah.
We don't know that he's a good person or that he has any good ideas.
That's why we have the campaign, Ann.
That's right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: would a Howard Schultz presidential run as an independent affect President Trump's reelection chances? A, yes, it would help President Trump. B, it would hurt President Trump. Or C, it wouldn't have an impact. Last week's question: is it time to end the president's annual State of the Union speech? 55% agree with Mitch Daniels and say yes, 45% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, this lawmaking session could see changes in alcohol rules at Indiana restaurants and grocery stores.
The proposed bill, which makes dozens of changes to Indiana alcohol laws, came out of a 2-year special study commission on the issue. Some provisions affect grocery stores. Clerks would have to be at least 21 years old and go through training to ring up alcohol, and the stores would have to keep all of their alcohol confined to one area. The grocery store's lobby opposes that provision. The bill also allows restaurants to let their customers bring in outside bottles of wine for a fee set by the restaurants. But some restaurant owners say they don't like that idea. They feel they'll be forced into doing so by their competitors, and they say allowing outside wine hurts their profits.
Yeah.
Nikki Kelly, we finally got Sunday sales through last session after a few years. Are lawmakers really ready for more big changes to the alcohol industry?
I think they could be, and I think this was always the plan. It's a two-pronged approach. They gave grocery stores and drugstores sort of their win with Sunday sales, which also happened to be what a lot of Hoosiers wanted. And now they're going to try to even the playing field a little, make their clerks also have to be 21, limit where they can put the alcohol so kids can't, you know, grab the plastic bottle of wine at the checkout counter, that kind of thing. So I think we will see some movement on that bill.
Does the fact that Sunday sales already passed actually, in a way, then make this easier because there's not the sort of attention on it?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, that was the big fish for a lot of Hoosiers, I think, for the average Hoosier. But Nikki's exactly right. This was part of a two-year plan. That was the structure all along about how this was going to be studied during the interim study committee. And then there is one deviation from the plan, though, and that is the first year, last year, when Sunday sales came about, was supposed to be all about retail. That's, you know, to consumer level. This year was going to be, the second phase was all about the industry more broadly and about wholesalers and so forth. Strangely enough, this seems to be just part two of retail in many ways.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a balance.
And I think it is for the very reason you mentioned. It is a matter of trying to recalibrate, or which is ironic because, of course, lawmakers will always tell you they don't pick winners and losers. But as every topic
that's true.
But every topic we have discussed today is, in fact, a verification that there are inevitably winners and losers.
Similar to the question I asked about the gaming bill, this is, I mean, I talked about one small portion. I mean, the digest for this bill is 2 pages long. Is this one of those that because it's all together, it makes it easier, or because it's all together, it goes down in flames?
You know, it's been my experience working with the legislature that when you have a one-page bill, everyone reads it, and when you have a 50-page bill, nobody reads it. And so the 50-page bills tend to pass because people always be told what is in it by the people who are working on it. So I think, you know, I think some of these changes are gonna go forward. They're gonna come out of the House. I don't know what appetite there is in the Senate to do kind of much of this. I would appreciate that when I go to the grocery store. Like, I still don't quite understand why someone just can't do this with my beer, and then move it down to. Yeah. Move it down the conveyor belt
so the
18-year-olds can actually bag it.
Yeah,
you know, but
that's true.
That part they can do. The other part they can't. So you know, that's just me. And now Ann will share the Chamber of Commerce's position
on why this should all be deregulated. No, actually, I agree with you. I've been saying for decades that I think they ought to abolish the Alcoholic Beverage Commission. I think these rules are absolutely absurd, and they do try to pick winners and losers, and
well,
they don't know how to do it.
I'm being facetious.
And it just all it does is interfere with people's use of alcohol and how they use it and all of that. You can prosecute people for drinking it too young, which we can do, but the Alcoholic Beverage Commission ought to get out of it. I mean, they just really ought to abolish it.
You just learned something very important, though. If anybody wants to be a lobbyist in the future, get a bill that's 1,000 pages. Throw everything in there. There never will be a question, right?
Ed Delaney reads every one.
That's true.
That's true.
But he might be the only one. A CNN poll released this week suggests 12% of Americans say they don't know who Vice President Mike Pence is.
Who is this man?
I have no idea.
Who is this man?
I don't know. I'm not going to lie.
The survey, conducted around the beginning of the month, largely asked respondents their opinions on President Donald Trump and his handling of various issues, but it also asked about Vice President Pence. Survey respondents were essentially split on their views of Pence, 39% approve, 40% disapprove, but 12% say they've never heard of the former Hoosier governor. The Indianapolis Star compared that number to past vice presidents at this point in their administration's terms, and Pence's never heard of him percentage is at least double that of the past three vice presidents.
Nobody's ever going to know who every politician is, John Schwanes, but is this number a problem for Mike Pence, who might have aspirations in the future?
Normally, a low name ID would be a problem for a politician. However, there are always exceptions to the rule, and everything I understood about politics is all changing anyway, so maybe this is one of those areas where name ID isn't your friend. For those who have disdain for this administration and for the person who's currently occupying the White House, it might be good to be a blank slate and not be closely associated with somebody who is on a lot of dark boards, figuratively speaking, around the country of people who want to see Donald Trump go at all costs. Keep in mind also that Mike Pence is extremely well known among the people that
he really needs. Well known among
I mean, he has been, if you look at straw polls from conservative groups meeting back to his, forget the governorship, back when he was a member of Congress.
Shutting down Congress, yeah.
He was the darling there, and they all know who he is. So I guess playing low profile in terms of your enemies may not be a bad strategy.
Is the biggest reaction from this sort of number just, how do you not know who the vice president is?
Sure. I mean, that's the easy thing to be appalled, and that's why we have those exact sort of man-on-the-street interviews is why we have a bill this year for all high school kids to take a civics test. I mean, I do think it's a little bit of a concern for Pence. I think he's going to need to find something in the next couple of years to make his and show, like, progress on. I mean, he hasn't been sort of the legislative guru that they thought he would. And, I mean, as far as I can tell, the best thing he's known for is the Space Force, which is made fun of more than, you know, anything. So, I mean, I do think there's a little bit in there.
Voter fraud, too, to be fair.
That
all
was
right.
So 2 years ago. So, I mean, he should probably start looking at how he's going to make a name if he wants to run.
Is there, though, I wondered exactly what John said, which is it okay to fly under the radar right now?
Look, you've got all these pictures. What you should have done is put him up there the way he always is, with that adoring look at Donald Trump on his face and his nodding head, so sincere. Then they'd know who he was. They'd know.
Is it just about context, then, Mike O'Brien?
Well, you're catching these poor people cold on the street and asking them.
It didn't look like that.
I don't think 88% is low for a sitting vice president second year in. The other interesting, if you went and I found the, I don't know if any of you went and found the poll, but they ranked kind of all the high profile political people. Yeah. Nancy Pelosi was at like 6%, which isn't.
A lot of people know Nancy Pelosi.
But that's like two decades in with hundreds, if not billions of dollars spent putting her name all over TV. So. I think there's just a segment of the population.
That just doesn't pay enough.
I think this says more about maybe the public.
This is an indictment of the public, yeah.
And
they should be watching SNL. Saturday Night Live is doing its best to make
Mike Pence a well-known
household
kind of pop culture icons on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. Well,
traditional public schools would have to split their voter-approved referenda funding with nearby charter schools under a bill proposed in the House.
House Education Committee Chair Bob Boehning's bill would have required any districts that pass funding referenda to share those dollars with local charter schools. But public school leaders pushed back, arguing the move would further worsen the situation for cash-strapped districts. Boehning pulled back from his proposal with a committee amendment to strip it out, but he says he still wants to make charter school funding more equitable. He says charters receive about $3,000 less from the state per student than traditional public schools.
Mike O'Brien, this is obviously an idea that Representative Boehning wants to pursue, whether it's now or in the future, more likely. But is it a good idea?
Well, I think for the people who have been like the most passionate like charter school and choice advocates, their contention has always been, it's your tax money. If you don't like the school that you, the only option you have in a K-12 public school, you can take your voucher and go use it at another option to get what you believe is a better education. But on the other hand, the way we've set this system up, we rely on the K-12 public schools to drive that process. So it's not the charters, and then we've tied their hands too. So we've not allowed them to raise money. We've not allowed them to do anything that's on the school property. We've not allowed them to talk to parents except through some separate organization, or you know, the public through some separate organization when you're running these campaigns. So the burden is always on the K-12.
Traditional
public school, and I don't see the charter schools coming in and investing in the same kind of resources, even though the tax dollars that are raised out of that process may be paid by people that are going to go use the charter schools.
They also may be paid by people who are not going for the charter schools, who don't even live in that district. But the bigger problem is that's not true, that they get $3,000 less from the state. They get the same money per pupil as everyone else does in that district, okay? And in many of those charter schools get $500 more per pupil as a capital allocation. So that's patently false, number one. And number two, the other thing is if people in a district vote to raise their taxes to support their public schools and have that money spent by the school board that these people elect, to have these interlopers come in who are not governed by anybody, certainly not governed by the school board, not answerable to the taxpayers at all, come in and grab some of those resources, it seems to me is patently undemocratic.
Yeah, he already pulled back from the proposal of this session. Is this perhaps a step a little too far for a lot of people at the State House?
I think it is. I think we finally found the step.
this is the line.
You know, I mean, the fact is that charter schools were sold in a way that they don't have to follow some of the same rules. Right. They have flexibility with teacher licensing. They're supposed to be able to be doing it differently and cheaper. But every year it's, no, we need more money, we need more money. In that case, we're just literally running like – 600 school districts, yeah. Essentially.
That's exactly, and that's, you think you're exactly right. It's a matter of you can't have it two ways. You can't say if you're a private institution or a charter school, we want your public money, but don't you dare ask us how about our record keeping or about our accountability. You got, if you want the money, you got to be treated in terms of accountability the way that any public school would.
Yeah. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Anne Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.